Ladies and gentlemen, please welcome to the stage Amy Poehler.
Thank you for coming, everybody. This is a reading for my audiobook. You know, you have to do your audiobook before your book even comes out, which I didn't know. So I'm just going to be reading a chapter tonight. I really appreciate all you guys coming on such short notice. Thank you so much for being here. The book is called Yes, Please, and it's coming out October 28th in theaters near you. And we're also videotaping this tonight, so if anyone is, you know, hiding from the law, that would be a good time to leave. And we're audio taping this so that you can listen to it in your car. Assuming is where you listen to your books. So I'm going to be reading a chapter, and I'll do a kind of a proper intro to it, but it'll be about 20 minutes or so. And then I'll take 3 hours of questions. No, I'm just kidding. No, then we'll be done. So I'm here at the Upright Citizens Brigade Theater, which is really exciting for me because there's a lot of stories about the UCB in this book. This particular chapter doesn't have a lot of UCB stories, which you would think is strange since I'm in the theater. But when you get the book, you will read so many. And listen to so many. I may stop and start at some point if I screw up, but I'm told that there's something charming about leaving those things in. So let's get started. I'm about to read the last chapter of my book, Yes, Please, and this chapter is called The Robots Will Kill Us All. A conclusion. In 1997, I proudly declared I would never own a cell phone. I was on a New York City street corner, and I was young, poor, and knee-deep in free time. A bunch of us were standing around smoking. A cigarette was my cell phone back then, a tiny social unit that helped me fill the day. Suddenly, we noticed Lou Reed walking our way. He strutted toward us like a grouchy mayor in a leather jacket. A Lou Reed sighting was like the first robin in spring. Seeing him meant your life was opening up and you finally lived in New York City. He passed by us and we all exhaled. One of my friends took out his cell phone and pretended to call the National Enquirer. It was one of those flip phones, a tiny pocket-sized clamshell that looked like a lady razor or a makeup compact. I held it and felt its weight. Nope, I said, I just don't need it. Cell phones aren't for me. What am I going to do, carry this thing around all day? When I was growing up, the Poehlers were the lower middle class family that had high-end gadgets. We had an amazing answering machine. It was as big as a toaster oven and used full-sized cassette tapes. I would come home and see the light blinking, excited that someone had tried to call us, even when we weren't around. I would rewind the tape with a giant button and listen to a strange voice asking me to renew my subscription to 17 magazine. That answering machine was a big deal. We fought over who would leave the outgoing message, each one of us believing that we would find the right mixture of humor and gravitas beneath our excruciating Boston accents. The answering machine was my personal secretary. I would run home from school and change the outgoing message as needed. Carrie, I'm going to the mall. Meet me at Brigham's. I didn't know Brigham's. And if you get there first, order me a chocolate chip on a sugar cone with Jimmy's. Sometimes you went somewhere and people didn't show up. There was no way to instantly reach them unless you went to their house or you called them on their home telephone number. MTV arrived not long after, and I would spend hours watching this incredibly cool and new station while thinking, finally, someone gets me. I was 10 and receiving a crash course in adult life. MTV introduced me to punk music and gay people. I met Michael Jackson, and his talent split me in half. I would dance all day in my basement listening to Off the Wall. You young people don't really understand how magical Michael Jackson was. No one thought he was strange. No one was laughing. We were all sitting in front of our TVs watching the Thriller video every hour on the hour, and we were staring open-mouthed as he moonwalked for the first time on the Motown 25th anniversary show. When he floated backward like a funky astronaut, I screamed out loud. There was no rewinding or rewatching, no next day memes or trends or Twitter or Facebook posts. We would call each other on our dial phones and we would stretch the cord down the hall, lying on our stomachs and discussing Michael Jackson's moves, George Michael's facial hair, and that scene in Purple Rain where Prince fingers Apollonia from behind. Moments came and they went, and if you missed them, you were shit out of luck. That's why my parents went to a MASH party, and they watched the last episode in real time. There was no next day MASH cast Google Hangout. That's why my family all squeezed onto one couch and watched the USA hockey team win the gold against evil Russia. And we all wept as my mother pointed out every team member from Boston. Everyone from Boston likes to point out everyone from Boston. Same goes with Canadians. And we all chanted USA and we screamed yes when Al Michaels asked us if we believed in miracles. Things happened in real time and you watched them together. There was no rewind. HBO arrived in our house that same year, and look, we had no business subscribing to HBO with the little money that we had, but Bill Poehler did not scrimp when it came to TV. I was a TV kid. There was no limit to how much I could watch. I even ate in front of the TV, and my parents will wince at this, but more than once, we ate in the living room with TV trays or at the kitchen table with the kitchen TV on. If we had money, we probably would have put a TV in every corner of our house. My parents didn't pay much attention to what I was watching because they were too busy working and remortgaging their house. And I was watching things on HBO that were much too scary and adult for my still-forming sponge brain. 70s and 80s movies were obsessed with Devil Kids, The Omen, The Exorcist, and Rapey Revenge. The Last House on the Left, Death Wish. There were moments in those films that were just scary enough and just sexy enough to burn into my brain and haunt my subconscious for years. But mostly, HBO was about adult content. And that meant movies about divorce and intrigue and betrayal. I learned how adults communicated from watching movies on HBO. I also learned what made me laugh. I watched every comedy I could find. Annie Hall, Caddyshack, Fletch, Airplane. I sat next to the TV and I transcribed The Jerk in blue composition notebooks. I thought about comedy. I thought about being a writer. Technology was creeping into my life in slow and manageable ways. The future was almost now. I spent my entire college career without a cell phone or email. Yeah. 42. I typed my papers on a Brother word processor, which had a window that showed 5 sentences at a time and had a tendency to go on the fritz and make you lose all your work. I typed papers in my dorm and I printed them out in my hallway because I didn't want to bother my roommate with the loud mechanical noise of the Brother spooling out tiny fists, the use of hands, and the early poems of E.E. Cummings. When I moved to Chicago, I used a paper map that folded in your lap to navigate the city. There was no internet, no email, no texting, no FaceTiming, no GPSing, no tweeting, no Facebooking, and no Instagramming. A few people in the late 80s had giant cell phones that lived in tiny suitcases, and I saw some in movies. I became aware of the existence of email and considered checking out this company called America Online. But the film War Games had taught me that computers could start a nuclear war. So I decided to wait and see. In the meantime, I wrote letters, and I maintained a healthy dose of eye contact. I still carried an address book. And now my phone sits in my pocket like a pack of cigarettes used to. I am obsessed and addicted, and I'm convinced that my phone is trying to kill me. I believe this to be true. And by the way, when I say my phone, I mean my phone and my iPad and my laptop and all technological devices in general. Look, I'm glad we have electricity and anesthesia, but I think this internet thing might be a bad idea. Sorry, guys. So far, the only good things I've seen come out of this recent technological renaissance are video chatting with your grandparents, online dating, and being able to attend traffic school on your computer. The rest is a disaster. The robots will kill us all. Here's proof. Number one, my phone does not want me to finish this book or do any work in general. After I wrote the first paragraph of this chapter, I checked my phone to see if anyone had emailed or texted, and then I Googled flip phone and when did Lou Reed die? Rest in peace, Lou Reed. That eventually led me to watching lovely Laurie Anderson videos and checking out a local place to learn Tai Chi. And then I went to Wikipedia and I clicked on Chinese medicine, and that reminded me of a healer I once had, which reminded me of a massage, which reminded me I needed to get my hair done. So I texted my hairdresser friend. She sent me a picture of herself from her recent trip. I put a filter on it with a funny caption and I sent it back. I don't remember doing any of this. I'm telling you, my phone wants me dead. It wants to sleep next to me and buzz at just the right intervals so I forget to eat or make deadlines. Number two, my phone does not want me to have friends. I'm not on social media, okay? It's just not my thing. There's an amount of self-disclosure and self-promotion involved that keeps me away, says the woman writing a book about herself. But I've learned to never say never. You know, perhaps in a year there will be some amazing new way to be funny, humble, real, and accidentally sexy all at the same time. With, you know, a really great filter option and a deep social message attached. I'm guessing it'll be called Soul Spill. Until then, I prefer to stick to group texting with my close friends. That's what I like to do. I love gathering four or five of the important folks in my life and forcing us to be our own tiny chat room. Remember those? I think if I've established anything in my book, it's that a key element of being my friend is being comfortable with my forced fun. I realize that a phone addict like me talking about how I don't do social media is like a heroin junkie bragging about how they would never touch meth. But I do like to do things that I'm good at, and I'm sure that having a bigger online presence would only get me in some shit because I have a history of texting the wrong things to the wrong people. Once I was wrapping Christmas gifts with an old assistant. She was a young and lovely girl whom I was thinking of firing. Let's call her Esmeralda, not her real name. So I texted my husband, Will, and I said, not now, not today, but eventually we should think about getting rid of Esmeralda. I went back to wrapping my gifts and chit-chatting about my upcoming schedule, and later that night I received a call from Esmeralda. I had sent her the text instead. I had sent it while we were together, and she read it while I was humming Christmas carols right in front of her. She figured we should talk. She was right. I fired her, and then I threw my phone across the room and I hid under my bed. Another time, I spent an afternoon talking to a friend about a recent relationship she had been in. She had gone back and forth with a guy who was acting like an asshole, and she had finally ended it and was processing her feelings. She left the room, and I texted another friend and wrote, "Oh, thank God they broke up, he's such an asshole." And then my friend came back into the room and asked why I had just texted her that weird sentence. And she was upset that I hadn't even waited 5 minutes before reaching out to someone else and talking about her. I apologized, I threw my phone into the garbage, and I tried to run myself over with my car. I wish I could tell you that these were the only times something like this happened, but it's happened over and over. An email for the wrong eyes, a text to the wrong person, a picture sent with the wrong message underneath. My inability to keep my shit straight made me straighten out my shit. And now, as a rule, I try not to text anything that I wouldn't mind the whole world seeing. I try to use restraints of pen and tongue and thumb. It's a constant struggle. If my phone had its druthers, it would butt dial my frenemies while I was in therapy. Number three, my phone wants me to feel bad about how I look. When I was younger, we used to have these things called parties, and there were these fun hangouts where young people would get together and talk and maybe dance. And during these parties, we would take pictures with these things called cameras. And 1 week later, we would go pick up those pictures from a strange man who lived in a tiny hut in the middle of town. By that time, the party had become a distant memory, something that I had experienced in real time with little regard as to how I looked. I would receive the hard copies of the pictures and I would throw away the ones I didn't like. No one would see those pictures but me. No one would be allowed to comment on those pictures until I decided to share them. They would be a reminder of a good time, but not something that kept me distanced from the experience. Now, my phone lets college admission officers check to see if an applicant ever posed in a bra. My phone wants to constantly let me know what other people think of me. It lures me into reading about myself. And at first, things seem really nice and great. I mean, my phone shows me lovely things that the internet made about my show or about my work, but my phone doesn't turn off after I see the good things. It stays on and in my hand until I scrape further. And then I find out that some people think I have a scary face. And while others just think I'm just not funny, period. And my phone shows me that I didn't really get a lot of emails over the weekend. My phone directs me to news which is gossipy and awful, which leads me to number four. My phone wants to show me things I shouldn't see. I read in a book once that the three things that shorten your life are smoking, artificial sweetener, and violent images. And I believe this to be true. Violent images are not new, but the immediacy with which we see them is faster than ever. During the horrific Boston bombings, I reached out to my family in Watertown, and I prayed for those who were injured, and I also went to news websites, and I was met with pictures of a man with his legs blown off. I was not ready for that. Whoever would be. Certainly not the man, who must now live with the pain and struggle of losing his legs, and also live with the pain and struggle of his image being disseminated in perpetuity. I mean, sure, those sorts of visuals have been around a long time. I saw R-rated movies on HBO. War photographers documented horrors and published them in magazines and books. But one used to have to go to the library or one's personal book collection to see Nick Ut's photograph of the naked South Vietnamese girl running after being severely burned. That picture was accompanied by text, and it had context. It was surrounded by other moving pictures that told a similar story. Now we can just look at the grotesque while we wait in line at the bank. Porn is everywhere. I am a fan of porn. It can be a very nice accompaniment to an evening of self-pleasure. It's as important as a good wine pairing. And look, lest you think I'm using fancy language to avoid revealing intimate porn preferences, please know that I prefer straight porn with occasional threesome scenarios that preferably don't end in facials. you too. Good. I also like men who seem to like women and women who seem to be on the top of their porn game. I basically like my porn like I like my comedy, done by professionals. But I'm a 43-year-old woman, so I can handle some of the images and feelings that porn conveys. I had a friend whose 7-year-old kid Googled the word naked once, and the first picture he saw was a woman with asparagus in her vagina and upper butt. I mean, that's just too much to handle. How are we ever gonna get him to eat his vegetables? The Dalai Lama has said that Hollywood is very bad for his eyes and a waste of time. And I understand. Most of what my phone shows me is bad for my eyes. My eyes need a rest, spiritually and literally. My eyes hurt from staring at my phone. But of course they do. My phone wants to kill me. Number 5, my phone wants me to love it more than my children. Last summer, I was sitting next to my youngest son, Abel, on the edge of a swimming pool. He slipped and went under. I jumped in and pulled him out right away. We were both a little scared, but thankfully everyone was fine. My phone had been in my back pocket, and my first thought was total triumph that I had chosen my child over my phone. My second thought was complete devastation that my phone had been submerged. I couldn't Google what to do with a wet phone because my phone was wet, so I quickly ripped it open and I started to dry it with a hairdryer, and then I used my laptop to get on the internet, where most sites told me to shove my wet phone in a bag of rice. So I just pulled out my little guy out of the pool, and I'm sweating in my kitchen as I poured rice into a Ziploc bag, and I spent the day without my phone, even though I had 2 other gadgets that allowed me to constantly check my emails and texts. I paced around hoping that the rice would soak up the water. It didn't. I realized I might have to go out that night without a cell phone. I put my iPad in my purse, just in case. I spent the entire dinner reaching for a phantom phone that I didn't have with me. This is the behavior of a crazy person. Don't you see what my phone is doing? Number 6. People text and drive and die. People check their emails and get hit by trucks. People fall into shopping mall fountains while texting. And security footage is passed around on the internet and that person dies of embarrassment. Enough said. Number 7. Number 7, my phone won't let me go. It used to be when we lost our phones, we really did lose them. We had to rebuild our contacts list. We had to send out emails telling everyone to send us their contact information again. We didn't have everything saved and backed up, and this gave us all a chance to reset. I'm a firm believer that every few years one needs to shake one's life through a sieve, like a miner in the Yukon. The gold nuggets remain. The rest falls through like the soft earth it is. Losing your contacts was a chance to shake the sieve. Now, everything's backed up on the cloud, and you can find your phone if you lose it in a taxi. Don't you realize it is only a matter of time before our phones can find us? Our phones have somehow convinced us that they aren't trying to kill us. Rather, they're trying to protect us. You are a ridiculous person if you are not reachable by phone or email. As a parent, you're expected to be constantly available at all times. You're encouraged to provide your children with their own devices. You're expected to monitor those devices, keep up with your children's technology, and have proper age-appropriate conversations about sexting and trolling, all while the super nerds create apps that allow you to send a picture that disappears within seconds. My phone has even gotten its grubby technological hands on this book. This book is expected to have a very big ebook presence. People don't buy books anymore, they buy ebooks, or maybe they buy both. Either way, it's very important that this sells as an electronic book. And I'm supposed to be excited about this. Gone are the days where you sat on your couch and you turned pages with Dorito-stained fingers. Gone are the days where you took Henry James on the train and you read it in front of a cute guy to try to impress him. Gone are the books stuffed with pressed flowers and handwritten notes and hotel room receipts. For a minute, I wanted this book to be stuffed with things that fell out when you opened it, but my editor said no. They actually didn't. I just didn't get my shit together in time. It's a whole thing. So, let's review. My phone is trying to kill me. It's a battery-charged rectangle of disappointment and possibility. It's a technological pacifier. I keep it beside me to make me feel less alone, unless I feel like making myself feel lonely. It can make me feel connected and unloved, ugly and important, sad and vindicated. So, what do we do? Well, first, we go back to the Dalai Lama. And he says, I think technology has really increased human ability, but technology cannot produce compassion. Man, that's good. That's why he's the big llama. He goes on to say, we are the controller of technology, and if we become a slave to technology, then that's not good. So we must work hard to not be slaves. We must find a way to fight against complacency and mindless patterns. How do we do it? How do we do this? How does it work in movies when the good guys go up against the robots? Number one, we try to destroy them. This is not happening. Technology is moving faster than ever. The internet is here to stay. Plus, telling someone to not look at bad pictures or comments online is like telling a kid not to eat a cookie. And I'm here to tell you that any actor who says they don't search for their own name on occasion is a filthy liar. Number two, we beat them at their own game. This series was an impetus for Smart Girls at the Party, a web series and website I created along with my friends Meredith Walker and Amy Miles. And we wanted to build a brand that attempted to combat the deluge of shit that young people see every day online. And it all started with the idea of one simple show. It would be a Charlie Rose type interview show for girls that ended in a spontaneous dance party. We wanted to celebrate the curious girl, the non-famous, the everyday warrior. And at first, we only knew a few things. We wanted to make content we would have watched when we were younger, and we wanted to end our episodes with a dance party. Spontaneous dance parties are very important in my life. I have one in the makeup trailer almost every afternoon on Parks and Recreation, and I think dancing is a great equalizer. It gets people out of their heads and into their bodies. And if you can dance and be free and not embarrassed, you can rule the world. Smart Girls is growing and changing, and Meredith and I have big plans to open up camps and create more content and connect with more and more young people. And our hope is to provide something for people who can't stand to look at another awful website highlighting some fame-obsessed garbage person. Number three, maybe the way we beat them is that we believe in people, not machines. So I will finish this reading, this chapter, and this book with a little story. And by the way, thank you for listening to Yes Please all the way to the end. Yeah. Thank you for coming and listening, and for those of you in your car, thank you for listening all the way to the end. I know how busy you are. During my writing process, I struggled with my limited relationship with technology. I was forced to buy a new laptop, and I grew to love my tiny MacBook Air with my badass black cover and UCB sticker on the front. And it's traveled with me for over a year and a half, as I have pretended to work on this book all across America. Recently, I flew to San Francisco to shoot the finale of our 6th season of Parks and Recreation. Life is endings and beginnings. Pema Chodron says we are constantly being thrown out of the nest. It can be hard, this life. Beautiful, too. Mine is beautiful, mostly. Lucky me. I arrived in San Francisco with that rare combination of sadness and joy. There should be a name for that feeling. Maybe it's intimacy. Either way, I had a wonderful time shooting the show and the shit with a cast of people I have grown to love like family. And after 2 days, I reached into my bag to pull out my laptop and work on a piece for the book. And my laptop was nowhere to be found. And my heart sank. I assumed it had been stolen. And then I had a terrible memory of putting it in a separate tray in the security line. I was tired the morning I flew to San Francisco. I fly a lot and it can wear you down. And I opted out of the X-ray machine because, I don't know, I was just getting tired of being zapped with rays that nobody could tell me were safe. I mean, if my phone is trying to kill me, then that crazy X-ray machine at airport security is a straight-up assassin. So I asked for a pat-down, and it was nice, actually. A sweet woman and I chatted as she touched me. I didn't mind, it felt human. She told me that she loved me and baby mama. And I went on my way. But because of the small change in my routine, I left my laptop at LAX security 48 hours before. So the first thing I did was cry. You know, because, see, I had a lot of writing on my laptop that I hadn't truly backed up. Maybe 40 or 50 pages. Technology can often feel like a club that didn't accept me, and so I punish it by ignoring it, which in turn often hurts me. Then I cried because I was tired and worried about this book and getting it done while also being a good mom and a pleasant face on camera. And then I cried because I knew this was a first world problem and I had no right to cry. And then I called TSA Lost and Found. I spoke to a human, a man. He took my information, he was polite, and he listened. He wasn't a machine. He put me on hold, and he took a quick look. And he came back and said he didn't see anything matching that description, and I started to cry again. And he said, "Come on, Amy, you gotta stay positive." I thanked him. He took my email, and I considered that my laptop was gone for good. And for like the millionth time during this process, I considered emailing my editors and asking them if I could give the money back and not write this book. The only difference was this time I had a real reason. A day later, I received this. An email to Amy Poehler from Sherita Fields, date March 5th, 2014 at 8:51 a.m. Subject, recovered laptop by LAX TSA Lost and Found. Hello, Mrs. Poehler. This is to inform you that your laptop was located by the TSA at LAX. Your TSA tracking item number is 14389, report number 192. TSA LAX Lost and Found only retains lost items for 30 days from the date of this email. You can stop by our office in person with your tracking number and photo ID. They will return your item. I have to go in. You get the idea. Please let me know if you have any questions. Sherita J. Fields, TSA Lost and Found, Airport Spectrum Building. Every book needs an angel. Yes, please, had Sherita Fields. I went straight to LAX Lost and Found and I recovered my laptop. And I explained to Sherita that I was writing a book and I had been sure that most of it was lost. I told her I would thank her in my book and in my audiobook and send her a copy as soon as I finished. She was polite and professional. She let me take her picture. I wish I could have a big blow up of it, but this is what Sherita looks like. You can't see, but in the picture, she's holding her glasses up to her chest, like, oh, bless. Like, she's just like, who, me? And she's standing in front of a sign that says Department of Homeland Security. So, you know she knows people. The only way we will survive is by being kind. The only way we can get by in this world is through the help we receive from others. No one can do it alone, no matter how great the machines are. Yes, please. Thank you, Sherita. Thank you. This is Amy Poehler. This production of Yes Please was produced and directed by Scott Sherritt. Recorded at my beautiful home studio by Joey Roberto, Charles de Montebello, Dominic Camardella, and Mike Fisher and Eric Harding. With the amazing voices, the best in the biz, Seth Meyers, Michael Schur, Carol Burnett, Patrick Stewart, and Kathleen Turner. Oh, and my parents, Bill and Eileen Poehler. Thank you to the UCB. The live performance was recorded in Los Angeles, California at the Upright Citizens Brigade Theater by Mark Holden and Wes Dewberry. Post-production by Danny Meltzer. Music by Freddie Kaw. Executive producer Aaron Wicks. Text copyright 2014 by Amy Poehler. Production copyright 2014 by HarperCollins Publishers. All rights reserved. Thank you for listening. Nailed it.